Yoda opened his eyes.
So am I.
No, Master.
Look, Master Kenobi. Look. Old and ugly. What see you?
Obi-Wan leaned down close. A luminous being, he said.
Hmph,
said Yoda, and closed his eyes again.
Annoying one's own words to use against him. A bad feeling I have about that.
But Obi-Wan was already gone. Yoda nestled deeply into Qui-Gon Jinn's cloak. He would sleep now. At least, he would try to sleep. His eyes opened. He probably would not sleep. It was not what he had wished for. Not at all. Still, for the first time in a long time, he was eager for the next day.
Palpatine, by Ian Desher.
Enter Emperor Palpatine, having received news from Darth Vader of Obi-Wan Kenobi's death.
Communication hath just been received, e'en better than my fantasies conceived. Darth Vader, my apprentice and my tool, the intimidating fist by which I rule, hath told me of Kenobi's swift demise, which news have struck me with profound surprise. Upon the Death Star, the Empire's latest threat, the battle was borne out, the old foes met. Kenobi, feeble, elderly and weak, have dared his former Padawan to seek. The two men met and clashed like fire and ice. Darth Vader, though, have triumphed in a trice. A few quick parries of his saber red, and old Kenobi fell, now heir, now dead. Our troopers now report 'twas Tatooine whereon Kenobi hid, unfound, unseen. And lo, these years hath lived in mystery, whilst I, the Emperor, made history. Why Tatooine? And wherefore there so long? What are the notes that formed Kenobi's song? What melody was it whereat he played? Why in those measures hath he so long stayed? Was he designing his own instrument? And wherefore were his wrists so prominent? His death should fill an emperor with glee. Forsooth, my heart should soar inside of me. Yet there is that which plagueth still my mind. Yea, questions to these answers I would find. For instance, there is this that still perplexes, a riddle that with obfuscation vexes. Darth Vader saith that at the very time, the second when he hath performed the crime, when his lightsaber struck Kenobi's robe, the Jedi's body vanished from the globe. Not slain precisely, nay, but disappeared. Which is enough to make e'en me afeared. Then too there are the final words of his, which Vader hath conveyed as 'twere a quiz. If thou dost strike me down, e'en now, e'en here, I shall more great and powerful appear than e'er thou hast imagined possible. These words are each like needles in my skull. Is this a simple lie, or Jedi trick? Is this the Force's might? Have I been thick? Is there aught that can make Kenobi live? Is there relief that logic yet can give? And even if Kenobi's dead and gone, another worry still comes hard upon. Although this wretched Jedi is destroyed, by Yoda is mine intellect annoyed. Where hath the errant, verdant coward fled? Somewhere within the galaxy his head doth wait to meet an emperor's dark rage, unless the weakling hath expired from age. If Yoda and Kenobi were alive, and somehow did our Jedi purge survive, what else exists of which we're unaware? What threat shall come by land or sea or air? I would be certain of our dominance. I would have proof of mine own prominence. For surety I'd give the universe. Yet questions dog me like a witch's curse. The answers to these things are still unknown, and doubts within my brain make endless drone. With mocking voice that speaketh, Palpatine, couldst thou not wipe thy rivals from the scene? Kenobi's death then gives but poor release, since worries do pursue me sans surcease. These matters shake me, though I should rejoice. Thus hear the proclamation of my voice. This moment marks a time that I shall savor. From now, the Empire's power ne'er shall waver. Today begins an era of resolve, as fully unto darkness we evolve. No slip of our foul purpose shall we know. No misstep shall e'er threaten to o'erthrow. No hidden Jedi plot shall give us pause. No vile uncertainty shall stay our cause. No mercy tolerated in our ranks. No weakness found within our data banks. Henceforth, the Empire shall not be assailed. Impervious will be no fault unveiled. A vulnerable realm's a dying breed. This shall not be the Empire's fate indeed. I shall have full control whatever come, and strike mine enemies both deaf and dumb. It starteth with the end of the rebellion, wherein I am the Reaper, Darth my Hellion. The Death Star, fully operational, shall wallop with a might sensational. Lord Vader's cunning found the rebel base. Anon he'll bring destruction on the place. By the Death Star shall the rogues be apprehended. Its list of massacres shall be extended. 'Twas Jeddah, Scarif, and then Alderaan. Next Yavin 4, with the rebels found thereon. This triumph cannot happen soon enow. Brought to its knees, the galaxy shall bow. Come, Death, and let the rebels know thy might. Thou ever wert our ally in a fight. Thou art the rider, the Empire's thy horse. Thou showest all the dark side of the Force. Thou art our strength, our talisman, our sign. Thou art supreme, and thy full strength is mine. I'll wield thee swiftly on the rebel gang, and bring on them their life-concluding pang. The noose of Vader spurs me onward still. Kenobi first, and by my iron will, the rebels and the galaxy entire shall call me Emperor, or see their pyre. Go, Palpatine. Release thine awful dread, until each filthy rebel knave is dead.
Exit.
Sparks, by Paul S. Kemp. Dex sat on the side of his bunk, elbows on his knees, staring at nothing, but thinking about everything. His past stretched out behind him, a line of events much longer than the future he saw remaining before him. The Empire was coming. Its power projected by way of a moon-sized battle station that had already destroyed more than one planet and murdered billions. Billions. Everyone knew someone who'd been on Alderaan or Scarif or Jeddah. Dex had even been to Alderaan once with his parents, years before the Republic had transformed into the Empire. Thinking of the people there, their lives obliterated in an instant of fire and pain, at once enraged and afflicted him. It was an atrocity, and he wanted the Empire to answer for it. But he wasn't naive. Whatever answer the Rebel Alliance would force from the Empire in just a few hours would be likely futile. He knew how things would probably end. Seemed to him their choices were to run from Yavin's moon and live, maybe, or to stay and fight and die. And no one was running. Not one person. Not anymore. Alderaan had put a fierce resolve in everyone, from support troops to pilots. They were done running. True, rumors swirled among the flight crews that Princess Organa had returned with some kind of secret intelligence about the Empire. But Dex didn't see how mere intelligence could help. The battle with the Death Star would come down to a test of flesh and metal. And the Empire had much more of both. The remaining Alliance forces on Yavin 4 were a ragtag collection of starfighters and light cruisers. Almost no capital ships had survived the battle at Scarif. Together, all their soldiers couldn't even operate a fraction of the Death Star. But even so, no one was running. Not one person. You fly your run and hit what you can. That was Gold Squadron's credo. Dex had internalized it long ago. He'd fly his damn run, come what may. And he had his own credo, too. One based on something his mother had often said. Small sparks can start big fires. Thinking of his mom chased his inner darkness and made him smile. In his mind's eye, he could see her in one of the simple dresses she favored. Gray hair in a bun, her crooked front teeth exposed in a smile. He took a deep breath, blew it out, filled with his flight suit and tried to square away his mental state. He checked the chrono. They had hours, a bit less, and then he'd fly his Y-wing at an enormous sphere of steel and weapons and do what he could. You fly your run. Small sparks. An interrogatory chirp brought him back to the present. He smiled at the battle-scarred R5 unit that had been with him since his run over Corellia. He'd nicknamed the droid Sparks. I was just thinking, Sparks. That's all. A sympathetic purr from Sparks. More beeps with a question mark at the end. Oh, about lots of things. Mostly about my mom and dad and Onderon. I haven't seen them in a long time. And my little sister, she'd be 12 now. 12. He shook his head. Time had passed so quickly, and now he had so little left. Sparks wheeled closer, hummed in sympathy. Did I ever tell you what my mom used to say about small sparks? That's why I named you Sparks. Well, that and the fire you started on Utapau's moon, remember? An embarrassed moan and shudder from Sparks. Dex smiled, patted the droid on his head, and lied. Listen, things are gonna be fine. Sparks' ambivalent beeps suggested that he saw through the words to the truth. We'll do what we can, right? We make our run. Sparks perked up, beeped enthusiastically. And hit what we can, Dex said. Right. In hindsight, he realized that his mother's phrase was the through line of his life. It had played through his mind when he joined the rebellion, had sustained him through dark times. He'd joined knowing that things looked bleak, but he always fancied himself a spark. Always imagined himself starting the big fire. But it appeared not. Instead, it looked like things would end on a backwater moon. A voice carried over the station's intercom.
The Imperial Space Station has entered the system. Report to your stations. Flight crews to the...
A long pause. The usual end to the sentence would have been, to the launch bay. After all, they'd already had their mission briefing. A crackle on the intercom.
All flight crews report immediately to the main briefing room.
Sparks were an observation. Dex stood. Agreed that it's odd. I'll go see what's what. See you at the ship. The briefing room, filled with pilots and flight crew, fell silent as General Dodonna spoke. His tone as somber as a eulogist's. Dex leaned in closer as the schematics of the Death Star appeared on the briefing room screen. General Dodonna explained its weakness. A tiny exhaust port at the end of a narrow trench. Someone would have to put a proton torpedo directly in it at precisely the right angle of approach. A few audible gasps answered the declaration. Several head shakes, a pervading sense of despondency. Someone across the room said the shot couldn't be made. Someone else, a voice Dex did not recognize, responded by saying something about shooting womp rats on Tatooine. Dex filtered it out. He'd already committed the details of the briefing to memory. He knew the shot could be made, and he figured he was just the pilot to make it. He could see the exhaust in his mind, as vivid as a picture. Dodonna's words hadn't increased his despondency. They'd dispelled it. He felt hopeful for the first time in several days. Small sparks, he thought, and big fires. They filed out of the briefing room and hustled for the flight deck, where ground crew and droids readied the fleet of X-Wings and Y-Wings. Dex hurried to his fighter. Sparks was already being lifted toward his socket. The droid chirped and whirred a melody as Dex climbed into his cockpit and started a system check. He felt like he was floating, already flying, already dropping a torpedo down the bunghole of that Imperial station and saving the rebellion. Davish called up from the flight deck. He was in his flight suit, his helmet in his right hand, the standard grin pasted on his time-worn face.
You gonna be a hero today, Dex?
Dex smiled down.
Gotta be someone, Davish.
I suppose it does, Davish said.
I'll see you up there.
Right behind you,
Davish said, and hurried toward his ship. Dex went through his pre-flight checklist quickly, saw that all was in order. Sparks beat the okay. The ground crew signaled that he was clear to go. He engaged the anti-grav and lifted off the pad.
Let's get up there, Sparks, he said.
The droid whistled eager agreement. Dex broke atmo and the blue gave way to the black. Sparks ran through a quick instrument and weapons check, beat that all was in order. He followed that with a word query about Dex's vital signs.
No, I'm fine, Dex told the droid. He was just giddy. He'd gone from hopeless to hopeful so quickly, he was still spinning from it.
He took a few deep, calming breaths, brought himself down, and found his focus.
On me, Gold Squadron, said Gold Leader over the comm.
Affirmatives around. The squad fell into attack formation, Dex on the starboard end of the V-pattern. Through the cockpit glass, he saw Red and Green Squadron's X-Wings in formation to his right, slightly lagging Gold's lead. They sped around and away from the moon, the usual banter carrying across the comms. As the Death Star came into view, the comm chatter fell silent, quieted by the enormity of the station. Even from a distance,
Dex could see the differentiated structures all over the station's surface. The huge convex disc that he knew served to focus the station's planet-busting weapon. He went over the broad strokes of the attack in his mind. First the turbo lasers, then the deflector stations, then Gold and Red would take the trench by turn. "No support craft," he said.
"Not yet," said Davish. "We get to eat some turbo lasers first."
Gold Leader's stern voice crackled through the comm.
"Less chatter and more focus. You know your jobs. Do them."
"We fly our run?"
Dex said.
"And hit what we can,"
Davish answered. The station grew in size as they sped toward it, until it filled Dex's field of view. Sparks scanned the station, fed pertinent information to Dex's heads-up display. Dex noted the location of the turbo lasers.
"Accelerate to attack speed," said Gold Leader.
Dex fired his engines.
"Deflectors at full, Sparks. Here we go."
As they closed on the Death Star, turbo lasers swung toward them and painted red lines across space. Dex pulled hard on the stick, rose, spun a circle, shoved it down, and opened up with his weapons. The Y-Wing's cannon sprayed the surface of the Death Star and burst plumes of flame. He jerked hard right, locked onto a turbo laser turret, fired, and watched it explode. Pulling back on the stick, he shot high over the surface of the battle station, chased by laser fire. He glanced down, saw the rest of Gold and Red squadrons darting over the surface of the station. The turbo lasers, designed as they were to defend the station against capital ships rather than fighters, had trouble tracking the elusive X and Y wings.
"Find me something else to blow up, Sparks,"
he said, and the droid fed him the coordinates for a deflector tower. He slammed the stick down and closed on the tower, flying straight into a spray of fire from a turbo laser. He spun the ship, dancing between the ionized lines, while Sparks whooped. He sprayed the turbo laser with his cannons, took it out, and turned hard at the deflector tower. He locked on, fired, and watched it blossom into flame.
"Nice shot, Gold Two," said Davish. "Someone's gotta be a hero,"
Dex answered. He pulled up, went high, and noticed that the turbo lasers had stopped firing. They could not have destroyed them all so fast, so that could mean only one thing. Gold Leader's voice affirmed his thinking.
"Fighters incoming. Gold 2 and 5, on me for the trench. The rest of the squad, engage the ties. Hold them off."
"Active scan, Sparks,"
Dex said, wheeling his Y-Wing in beside Gold Leader and Davish.
"Let me know if we get any attention from the ties."
Sparks beeped agreement. Below them, elements of Red Squadron engaged with the ties that had poured out of the station's launch bays.
"It'll be tight in the trench,"
Gold Leader said.
"Hold formation, whatever comes. I lead, you two lagging on my nacelles. Copy?"
"Copy." "Copy,"
Davish and Dex said in sequence. A few moments of quiet. Then Gold Leader said,
"We go."
The three Y-Wings streaked toward the trench. Dex's vision distilled down to the dark line of it. A gash cross-cutting the battle station. In his mind, he pictured the exhaust port at its end. They needed to fly in the trench to allow their targeting computers to properly calculate the shot.
"All systems square, Sparks?"
The droid beeped an affirmative. The three Y-Wings swooped down into the shadowy trench, Dex and Davish right behind Gold Leader's engine nacelles. The flying felt claustrophobic. The sides of the trench were a blur, whipping past at a dizzying speed. Dex kept his eyes forward and on his instruments so as not to get disoriented. The distance to the exhaust port showed as a countdown on his heads up. They were getting close. "Small sparks," he thought. "Small sparks." Sparks beeped a warning a moment before Gold Leader said,
"They're coming in. 3 marks at 2:10.
The scanner showed ties in the trench behind them, closing fast. Dex compared their closing speed with the remaining distance to the exhaust port. It would be close.
Engines at full, Gold Leader said. And hold formation, dammit!
Sparks adjusted power settings, increasing the engine's output, and the Y-Wing accelerated. Rear deflectors at full, Dex said, and Sparks redirected power. Dex was sweating under his flight suit, his breath coming fast, white-knuckling the stick. The narrowness of the trench gave him no room to maneuver. He stared at the display that showed the approaching exhaust port. He was just waiting for his targeting computer to affirm a lock. Almost there. Almost. Come on, come on! A shot from one of the TIEs struck the side of the trench, exploded, and the blast wave wobbled Dex's Y-Wing. He scraped the side of the trench wall, but straightened up. I'm good, he said. I'm good. The TIEs had closed faster than expected. He checked the heads up again. So close.
Hold formation,
Gold Leader said, his normally emotionless voice tight with tension.
Wobble as best you can, but do not break off.
There was no real room to wobble the craft, though. Not without risking a collision. They just have to rely on their deflectors. They were nearly to the port. Everything we have to the rear deflector, Sparks! More shots from the TIEs put red lines over his cockpit. Almost there. His ship shook with a sudden impact, as if kicked from behind. Siren screamed. The depressurization warning. Sparks beeped an alarm. I'm hit, Dex said, calmer than he would have expected. Deflector down. I'm holding formation. I'm holding. Smoke leaked from his control panel. Sparks sizzling from an electrical short somewhere deep in the electronics. The stick felt heavy in his hand, unresponsive. He found it hard to breathe. The ship lurched again, and the pressure wave from an explosion in the rear caused him to see Sparks. Sparks let out an alarmed squeal that cut short. Dex flashed on his mom, her smile, his dad and his mustache, his sister's giggle. Someone had to be the hero. Someone had to be... A flash of orange. A brief moment of searing heat. A roar in his ears, as much felt as heard. Then nothing more.
Duty Roster by Jason Fry. You know I hate that nickname, Cole said. He knew immediately that he'd made another mistake. Puck Nako was immune to fear and disinclined to mercy, whether behind the stick of a T-65 starfighter or killing time in the ready room deep within Yavin 4's Masasi Temple. A corner of Puck's mouth twitched upward. As it happened too many times in simulations, Cole had let the older pilot maneuver him into position for the kill shot. Two other pilots, John D. Brannan and Theron Nett, exchanged an amused glance.
What have I told you about taking the bait? Puck asked Cole.
Cole sighed.
Not to. And what did you just do?
Took the bait. Can't you think of something else, though? I mean, we don't even look alike.
You do to me,
rumbled the Mon Calamari ground tech Kalima, one lamp-like eye swiveling up from patching a leaking oxygen hose.
But then you all do.
Very helpful, Cal, Cole muttered.
And you sound exactly alike. It's uncanny, really. I'd swear you were the same person.
Puck grinned. He's got you there, Fate. Don't, Cole said, his voice loud enough that the other pilots looked over. I mean it, Puck, he said more quietly. Don't. Today of all days, don't. Somehow that succeeded where previous efforts hadn't. Puck nodded and raised his hands peaceably.
So what exactly did the kid say that set you off, Call?
Asked John D.
In all the excitement, I missed that.
Well, I just said that it's impossible to hit a 2-meter target with a proton torpedo, even with a computer. A glance passed between Puck and John D. What? Don't tell me you weren't thinking the same thing while Dodonna was showing us those schematics.
Maybe, John D. said. I'm guessing the kid thought it was possible. What do you say?
The door opened and other pilots began entering the room in twos and threes. Cole spotted Biggs Darklighter, a newcomer whose carefully groomed mustache was another of Puck's favorite targets. Grim gravel-voiced Elihek Rue, the talented volatile Bren Quercy, and cool, analytically-minded Wenton Chan. And trailing behind them, the last person Cole wanted to see, Wedge Antilles, the young pilot he was sure had been sent to Yavin 4 solely to bedevil him. Look, it was nothing, Cole told John D. Forget it.
Really? Puck asked. A minute ago, you were having one of your fits.
Rue, at the end of the line for the calf dispenser, looked up absently.
What's this about, Antilles?
He began. Then peered more closely at Cole.
Oh. Sorry.
Cole knew his face was reddening even before the laughter began. Puck slung an arm around his shoulder.
And that, Cole Tackbright, is why you are and will always be known around here as Fake Wedge.
In his calmer moments, Cole knew the nickname had struck for reasons beyond a superficial resemblance to Antilles. During mission briefings, Antilles limited himself to a few specific questions, while Cole wanted to know if Starfighter Command had analyzed all the alternatives. When things went wrong in the simulator, Antilles reviewed telemetry while Cole vented his rage on helmets and furniture. Even their helmets were opposites. Wedges, a matte green, Cole's, a riot of yellow racing stripes. Garvin Drace, Red Squadron's craggy-faced, sad-eyed commander, had lectured Cole after his eruptions. So had General Merrick, who'd died with too many others at Scarif. And veterans such as Puck and John D. had tried to reinforce the message. Cole knew Puck's teasing was meant to help him develop thicker skin. Cole had tried to be more like the pilots praised for their placid exteriors. Pilots like Chan and Antilles. But inevitably, another feeling would steal over him as he lay in his bunk staring at the stone ceiling. Every day, the Empire was devouring worlds for ore and fuel and murdering those who dared to oppose it. Cole had watched in increasing agitation as evil crept across the galaxy, until he'd realized he couldn't spend another day in his placid homeworld doing nothing. He'd left Uquine that night with some credits, a duffel bag, and a vow to avenge those the Empire had wronged.
Maybe he'd lie in the darkness and think the Rebellion's problem wasn't that Colonel Tackbright was too angry. Maybe it was that people like Wedge Antilles weren't angry enough.
The other pilots laughed, but Antilles looked pained and turned away. Cole assumed he was embarrassed at being mistaken for the squadron scapegoat. Rue, meanwhile, had abandoned the calf line.
Sorry, Tackbright, he said quietly. I wasn't trying to be funny. My mind was somewhere else, that's all.
Forget it, Cole said, knowing this time Puck hadn't set him up. The next practical joke Rue played would be his first. John D. caught Cole's eye and inclined his head.
Sit.
Cole choked down his anger and did so. A moment later, Antilles settled into the chair next to him with a sigh.
I think it's time to switch things up, he said.
Hey guys, it's me. Fake Cole. Cole's first instinct was to knock Antilles onto the floor and show the whole squadron the joke ended here. But Red Leader would arrive soon with the pilot roster for the Death Star mission, and Cole would be an easy cut if found brawling with a fellow pilot. And that wouldn't be right. Cole had earned the right to be part of the most important mission in Alliance history. No, he hadn't flown at Scarif. The last place in the squadron had gone to Pedron Gall, who died there. But Drace had praised his performance in recent raids, and Cole had racked up patrols and recon missions. He just had to keep his cool and hope for the best.
Tackbright! You still haven't told us what the kid said.
That was John D. again, like a neck with a bone. Still, it was better than this embarrassed silence, or whatever torment Puck might think up next.
He told me he used to bullseye some kind of varmint back home in, get this, a T-16. Biggs looked over and wagged a finger at Cole.
Hey, don't knock T-16s. I learned to fly on them. If you can handle a skyhopper, you can handle an X-Wing. Before Biggs crafts another ode to the galaxy's noble bush pilots, I want to hear more about the varmint,
Puck said. Cole furrowed his brow.
He called it a womp rat, whatever that is.
Biggs turned so quickly that Calf sloshed out of his cup.
A womp rat? You're sure that's what he said?
Can I make up a name like that?
No way, it can't be.
And then Biggs was rushing for the door, nearly toppling Drace as he entered the ready room with Zal Dinis and Rayla Sorrell at his heels. The squadron leader shot a curious look in Biggs's direction. Pilots tended to rush in when the old man arrived, not hurry out. Then shrugged. Chairs scraped on the ancient stone floor as the pilots stood. Cole spotted the muscles of jaws working and fingers tugging at uniforms. These men and women would be all business in their cockpits. But this part made them nervous. These were the moments in which they'd learn who'd fly and who'd be left dirtside, to lunge for control yokes and triggers that weren't there.
At ease, Drace said. Save it for 0 hour.
No one sat.
Like that, huh? Can't say I blame you. Let's get to it. You all know we have more pilots than birds. Given our losses at Scarif, we're trying to figure out if we can even put green and blue squadrons together. I'd fly with anyone in this room. And you all deserve a place on this op. But unfortunately, that can't happen. Silence hung over the room. First flight, Drace began. I'm flying lead. Tharren, starboard wing as red 10. Puck, your port is red 12.
As usual, Ned had no reaction. But Puck blew his breath out and nodded to himself. The first time Cole had ever seen him look nervous. Cole tried to think along with Drace. Red Squadron's 12 X-Wings were divided into 4 flights of 3 starfighters each. Drace normally flew with Nett and Sorrell as his wingmates. Since he'd subbed Puck for Raylo, in all likelihood he decided...
Raylo, you'll lead second flight as Red 11, Drace said. Wings are Brannon and Binley as Red 4 and Red 7.
That wasn't a surprise either. John D. was a veteran and Har Binley had flown well at Scarif.
Third flight, Drace said.
And Cole noticed eyes narrowing and postures growing rigid. Third and fourth flights were where Drace had needed to make tough choices.
Zal, you'll fly lead as Red 8. Wings are Natan and Porkins, as Red 9 and Red 6.
Dennis' only reaction was to nod briefly at Nozo Natan and Jack Porkins. One flight to go. Cole's eyes skittered over Antilles and Shan, Rue and Quirzy, and the other pilots on the bubble.
Fourth flight. We'll be led by the new kid, Luke Skywalker, Drace said.
That was not expected. The pilots muttered and exchanged startled looks.
The Womp Rat kid?
Cole demanded, drawing an exasperated look from Puck.
Is that what we're calling him? Drace asked. He'll fly as Red 5, assuming his simulator run checks out. Before anyone else has something to say, remember that without Skywalker, the princess would have been executed, and we'd be going up against the battle station with nothing but prayers.
2 slots left in the squadron. Puck fixed Cole with a stern look that he didn't need to interpret. Dark Lighter would be Luke's starboard wingman, flying as Red 3, Drace said.
Assuming someone can find Biggs by the time we fly.
1 seat left. Cole prayed that the old man wouldn't let him down.
Wedge, you'll be port wing flying as Red 2. But see Kalima about your bird. He's got a couple of things to go over with you.
Cole leaned against the wall and stared down at his flight suit, numbly registering the chest-mounted life support unit and the band of signal flares around his lower leg. Both useless. He didn't need gear to sit and wait while others did the job he'd been meant to do.
I'm not much for speeches, but seems like the occasion calls for one, Drace said. You know there's a tough target waiting for us. Just like you know that a lot of brave people, including friends of ours, gave their lives so we'd have a chance to take that target down. Someone clapped a couple of times, stopping when no one joined in. You're every bit as brave as they were, Dre said. I saw that just a few days ago. I know in the next hour I'll see it again. We'll rely on one another up there like we always do. And as long as we do that, I'll go up against anything in the galaxy and like our chances. All right, that's it. Techs have already started pre-flight. Get to your birds in 10 minutes and I'll see you up there. Call remained motionless as the other pilots and techs began filing out of the room. Tough break, kid, said Puck. Stay sharp. If they can get more birds flying, they're going to need pilots.
But Red Squadron's got its 12, Cole said. So even if that happens, I'll be at the back of the line.
Puck started to say something, but Cole turned away.
Just leave me alone,
he said, leaning his forehead against the wall. The ancient stone felt soothingly smooth and cool. The room quieted, and when Cole looked up, he was alone. The only sound was the hum of the air scrubbers fighting their rearguard action against the jungle moon's relentless humidity. The chairs were askew, and ration bar wrappers and half-empty cups of caff dotted the tabletops.
Someone needs to clean this up. If Colonel Kor sees the ready room like this, the demerits will fly.
Except, there wouldn't be a next briefing. Soon, everything around him would be part of a cooling debris field in the earliest stages of becoming a ring of Yavin. What was the point of cleaning up? What was the point of doing anything except waiting to die? The fury came all at once. Chairs flew, tables overturned, and still Call raged on, looking for new targets. He spotted his flight helmet, hanging by its chin strap from a rack on the wall. That would do nicely, he thought. Taking a step toward the helmet and the one hanging next to it. The matte green one hanging next to it. Oh. The door opened, and Antilli stared at the wreckage and Call standing in the center of it, breathing heavily.
I guess you forgot your helmet,
Call said, his voice low and strange in his ears. Kalima had to ask where it was, Antilli said, stepping carefully over a tangle of fallen chairs.
Not the best way to start a hop.
Antilles avoided Call's eyes as he made his way to the rack, took his helmet down, and picked his way back to the door. But then he paused and turned.
I'm sorry you're not going up with us, Antilles said. I mean that, Call. And I had nothing to do with that idiot nickname.
You've got no reason to be sorry,
Call said with a smirk.
You get to fly against the Empire, while good pilots like me sit down here and do nothing. Just remember that you're flying for all of us, and you better not let us down.
Antilles nodded, but his eyes had turned hard and flinty.
I'll fly for you, Call, and for a lot of other people, too. The whole galaxy's counting on us, you know. You're not alone in this fight, and you never will be. Unless you insist on pushing everybody away.
The sound of Antilles' departing footsteps grew fainter and was lost amid distant voices, whining machinery, and muffled announcements. The activity of a rebel base ready for war. Call listened for a moment longer, then began to right the tables and chairs. When he entered the war room, Call immediately spotted Princess Leia, a slim figure in white at the main command table, with Dodonna and other rebel bigwigs. He scanned the room and found the knot of orange flight suits at an auxiliary display. Rue, Chan, Quirzy, and Kalima. Call steeled himself for their reaction, but the others simply nodded, with Rue and Chan making room for him at the table.
Battle stations orbiting the gas giant, Chan said. Less than 15 minutes to firing range.
So when do they call K-10?
Call asked.
Don't think they're planning to evacuate, Quirzy said. Most of the essential equipment left with the fleet. It's all in the hands of the pilots upstairs.
And there's nothing I can do about it, Call thought.
The pilots were the last line of defense against the Empire's planet killer. They'd need every advantage they could get, and a lot of luck. Kalima tapped at a readout on the tactical display, muttering at what he saw. "Problem with one of our birds, Cal?" Chan asked.
"Port stabilizer on Red 12's misaligned. But Nako knows to compensate for it. I'm more worried about Red 2. We had to do a patch job on the stern hydraulic lines after Scarif."
"Wedge can handle it," Chan assured him. Carl retraced schematics in his mind and didn't like what he found. "If those lines fail, his micromaneuvering controls will go too."
"Bantilles knows that and still wanted to go," Kalima said. "It was fly with the patches or don't fly at all."
"That's a big risk," Carl said, which drew a bark of laughter from Quercy. "Look around, Carl. We're all a part of the biggest risk in the history of the galaxy." Over the speakers, Gold Leader announced the start of the Y-Wing's attack run, with Red Leader directing his X-Wings to cut across the battle station's axis and draw the Imperial's fire. Call stared at the tactical display, trying to match the bright blips indicating the fighters' positions with the chatter on the squadron channel. The X-Wings had broken into pairs and trios, raking the surface of the battle station with laser fire. They were a distraction, harrying the Imperial defenses while the Y-Wings raced for the vulnerable exhaust port. Pilots he'd served alongside were risking their lives for a slight increase in their alliance's odds.
"They're outflying those turbo lasers," Kalima grunted. "Those guns are meant for capital ships, not starfighters."
And then Porkins announced he had a problem, and the red dot that represented Red 6 slowed. An agonized yell was drowned in static and the dot vanished.
"So long, Piggy," Rue said quietly. "You will be avenged."
An alarm sent controllers scrambling. Kalima waved a mottled hand at new lights, blinking on the tactical readout.
"Ties," Rue said. "If the Empire's jamming our sensors, those fighters will be right on top of our birds before they're detected."
A warning went out to the pilots, and the table became a shifting constellation of red and green. Call realized he was gripping the edge of the table so hard that his knuckles were white. He told himself to relax, then realized the other pilots were doing the same thing. A green dot attached itself to John D., and a moment later, the rebel veteran was dead. Then Skywalker took a glancing hit from a tie just before flying into a heavy fire zone. Both the red and green blips vanished, and Chan leaned closer.
"Did we lose the kid?"
The two blips reappeared, and Skywalker called out for Biggs. But it was Red 2 that vaporized the Imperial pursuer.
"That's Antilles' third kill," Kalima said. "Wish he wouldn't ride those patches so hard."
"Shh," Chan said. "Gold Squadron starting its attack run."
Carl studied the telemetry from the Y-Wing sensors and shook his head.
"They've got no room to maneuver in that trench. With all those guns down there, their forward shields will take a beating."
The Y-Wing pilots switched on their targeting computers, and numbers began counting down on one section of the readout.
"The guns, they've stopped!"
Gold 2 said in disbelief. A moment later, TIE fighters swooped in from behind. Call tried to will the targeting numbers closer to zero. Then, Gold 2 was dead, followed by Gold Leader. Gold 5, doomed, was warning Red Squadron that the fighters had come from behind, and the Death Star was less than 5 minutes from clearing the planet. Carl realized he'd been holding his breath and let it out in a ragged stream. He stared at the tactical readout, trying to count the red dots.
"The other Y-Wings are being chewed up," Chan said, seeing his gaze. "And Red 8 and Red 7 were shot down skirmishing ties."
Dinnis was dead, and Binley too. Carl remembered the pride in their faces after Scarif. How he'd ached for the chance to fly with them.
"The old man's up next," Bruce said. "He'll make that shot, you watch."
Carl nodded, trying to convince himself. Wasn't Drace a legend, with a flight log dating back to the Clone Wars? And didn't he have Theron and Puck backing him up? He imagined Puck destroying the battle station and becoming a rebel hero. and choosing Call as his wing as the Alliance pursued more victories. With the Death Star 3 minutes from firing, Dodonna told Drace to keep half his group out of range for another potential attack run.
"We won't get a third shot at this,"
Call said, and Chen shushed him. Drace ordered Skywalker, Darklighter, and Antilles to hold their positions while Red 9 and Red 11 kept skirmishing with TIEs. As the three X-Wings swung into the trench, Call found himself muttering under his breath, begging Puck to watch out and urging whatever cosmic forces had shaped the universe to guide Drace's torpedo. Rue stood stock still at the tactical table, sweat running down his forehead. Corsi kicked relentlessly at the stone floor. Chan gnawed his lower lip.
"That's 6 kills for Antilles," said Kalima. "I fix something, it stays fixed."
Call stared at the three dots, approaching the blinking cross that marked the exhaust port, trying to speed them up.
"Keep your eyes open for those fighters," Drace said.
A chime announced that his targeting computer had the target marked and locked in.
"Come on, boss, come on," Call said.
And then there was a cry, and the blip representing Red 12 blinked out. Puck was dead. Call looked down, blinking hard.
"You'd better let her loose," Natan urged. "They're right behind me."
"Almost there,"
Drace said, his voice almost pleading.
"I can't hold them,"
Natan warned, and they wailed in anguish. Another chime. Drace yelled,
"It's away,"
and a dozen conversations started at once.
"It's a hit,"
someone yelled in the squadron channel. Call stared at Quirzy, seeing the same wild hope he knew was on his own face.
"Negative,"
Drace said as the green dots closed in his position.
"It didn't go in. Just impacted on the surface."
He ordered Skywalker to get set up for his attack run. And then the old man's starboard engine was scrap. Drace howled until his X-Wing smashed into the station's surface. A cool voice announced the Death Star's time to firing range. A minute and closing.
"Biggs, Wedge, let's close it up,"
said Skywalker, sounding far older than the young man in dusty clothes who sat next to Call.
"We're going in. We're going in full throttle."
The three X-Wings raced into the trench with Skywalker leading and Darklighter and Antilles farther behind to impede the fighters everyone knew were coming. At those near-suicidal speeds, Call knew any mistake would send a starfighter careening into the trench wall, or another T-65. Red 9 vanished, leaving Red 11 as a solitary red blip surrounded by green dots.
"Get Sorrow out of there," Call begged. "He can't survive those odds."
"No," Chan said, "but he can buy them a little more time."
"Fighters,"
Antilles said.
"Coming in point 3.
As Skywalker's targeting computer picked up its lock, something blinked on Kalima's tactical readout, and the tech's maroon skin turned a pale salmon.
"Antilles is hit," he said. "Shot severed the hydraulic lines. If he doesn't get clear, he's as big a danger as those TIEs."
Call could almost see Wedge fighting a slewing and bucking starfighter while trapped in the narrow trench.
"Tell him, Kel,"
Call urged.
"I'll never get through.
I can't stay with you,"
Antilles said bleakly, and the red blip zoomed away from the trench. Seconds later, the dot representing Sorrel disappeared. Red Squadron had been reduced to Skywalker and Darklighter.
"The TIEs are accelerating," Chan said. "Now it's a race."
"Hurry up, Luke,"
Darklighter said, then hesitated.
"Wait,"
he said plaintively, a split second before he died. 30 seconds to firing. Call spotted the red blip that was Wedge, heading back toward the trench with a cloud of TIEs closing in.
"What's he doing?"
Kalima studied his instruments.
"He's charged the auxiliary hydraulics, but that'll only give him a minute of fine control at most. If he goes back in that trench, he'll never come out."
Call silently begged Wedge not to throw his life away, not after having survived such odds. But he suspected he'd have done the same thing, recklessly trying to rejoin the fight rather than let people think he'd run. Nobody who'd flown a T-65 would say that. but did Wedge realize that right now? And if their positions had been reversed, as Call had so fervently hoped, would Call have realized it? And then everything seemed to happen at once. The Death Star cleared the planet. Skywalker's targeting computer shut down, and the Womp Rat Kid claimed nothing was wrong. The freighter that had returned Princess Leia to Yavin 4 came out of nowhere, scattering Skywalker's pursuers with a suicidal charge. And Wedge, instead of dropping into the trench using the last drizzles of hydraulic fluid, turned his X-Wing away from the Death Star. Skywalker's torpedoes fired. Call thought he heard the young pilot gasp as they ignited, and the noise in the war room rose in pitch and volume. The Death Star vanished from the tactical boards, leaving just four red blips against the blank expanse. Call and the other pilots stared down at the readouts. No one breathed. No one dared to speak. "Target destroyed," a controller said, and the war room descended into pandemonium. Call found himself pounding Rue on the back, hugging Quirzy and Kalima and slapping hands with Chan so hard that it hurt. Then he was swept up in the throng, the pilots, soldiers, and technicians rushing for the main hangar. They arrived in time to see the freighter set down outside the temple, with a Y-wing landing nearby, and two battered X-wings easing into the hangar. Most of the crowd headed for the T-65 with the five chevrons on each wing. But Call's destination was the X-Wing attended by only a scattering of rebels. He was waiting at the bottom of the ladder when Wedge slowly descended, facing away from Call. Wedge removed his helmet, his back still turned. His hair was matted with sweat, and his shoulders rose and fell. When Wedge turned, he saw Call and took an instinctive step backward. "There is nothing I could have done." And then Call wrapped him in a bear hug. "You took out six ties, ran that trench at full throttle, kept your bird intact without its maneuvering systems. You did all that and then you tried to go back, you crazy fool," he said. "You did everything anyone could have done and more." When he finally let Wedge go, the other pilot gave to him. "I just hope everyone sees it the way you do." Call threw an arm around his shoulders. "If they don't, tell them it was fake Wedge up there," he said. "Because I'd be honored to be mistaken for you. For any of you. Now come on. There's a celebration waiting for us."
Desert Sun by Pierce Brown.
The fear, which I know will last till I see the winged eyeball silhouette of TIE fighters tearing headlong toward me through black space, metastasizes in my gut as Dodonna's briefing comes to an end. But there's another feeling, the same that I felt before the mutiny on the Rand Ecliptic. Peace. A feeling of serene completeness. As if the nomadic path that took me to the Imperial Academy, to my first post on the Rand Ecliptic, and to my subsequent defection to the Alliance, has brought me full circle. As if parsecs from Tatooine, billions of kilometers from Tashi Station and the moisture farms of my family, have found home again. I heard his voice in the briefing. I saw his farm boy face, the same that used to smirk at me before a run on Beggar's Canyon, or when he'd waste a Womp Rat at full pitch. But still, I didn't believe my eyes. The kid's sandy tuft of hair disappears out of the tunnel from Dodonna's debrief like the rump of a fleeing bantha. I call after him, but he doesn't hear. I caught wind from Wedge that the princess had been brought back by a farm boy and a smuggler. But there's more agricultural systems under the Empire's boot than the grains of sand on a Mon Calamari beach. Even a top-of-the-line protocol droid couldn't calculate the odds of the farm boy being a son of Tatooine. Much less the only bush pilot besides myself who's ever threaded his way through Stone Needle in Beggar's Canyon. But it feels so purposeful, so fated. Just as my path has led me here, to the point of crisis, where I can strike a blow for freedom. It's brought my best friend as well. What luck. It's as if all the stories we heard as children were true. I pushed my way through rebel flight officers